from Euros Worldwide. This is FSN.
Yeah, cheers, Ollie. Thank you. That was a bit bizarre, wasn't it? We don't often expect... Well, we don't expect to hear from R. Kelly on the Richie Allen Show. Right, it's Wednesday. It's wet and, well, it's grey and dull here in Madchester. It is the 6th of March, 2018. Spring... 19, even. 19, Richie. Spring is just around the corner. Thank heavens for that. Good to be back with you, of course. Two top guests today. Tell you more about that in a minute.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show. It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yes, and Dr. Stuart Wayton, PhD, will join the program in the second hour, and we will be talking about all matters concerning freedom of speech in 2019. He's a terrific academic and author. You don't want to miss him coming up in hour two. Before that, I welcome back an old friend of ours, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, to the programme. I'm sure Paul will have a lot to say about the treatment of the Democratic Congresswoman, Ilhan Omar. Talked about this yesterday. Lots more to talk about, though, with Paul. He joins me this hour. It's live on Fab Radio 2, my website, TuneIn Radio, triggerwarning.tv. And as always, I love hearing from you, so do tweet the programme right now. It's at Richie Allen Show. That is the Twitter handle. Yeah. How are you, Jen? In the States, sometimes in California, sometimes in Florida. How you doing? Hi to Charlotte as well. Yeah, or Kelly, eh? A lot of people very excited today about the Michael Jackson documentary, which will be on UK Channel 4 television tonight. The first leg of it will, anyway, part one. I think part two tomorrow. I was going to do something on that yesterday, because when I talked about... when I did a radio show in Spain years ago, it was a three-hour live show 5 days a week. I would have a monologue, like I do now, and I would have a guest in hour one, a guest in hour two, like I do now. But then in hour three, this is typical Spain, I just basically sat back and opened the phone. And I would get all manner of callers talking about all manner of things. And one evening, there was an African-American man who had moved to Spain. And he rang up to tell me that he believed that the Michael Jackson thing was a conspiracy because of the love and respect that people had for Michael Jackson, and because he was a very powerful man and a very powerful figure. I don't know anything about any of that. You might be interested in the Michael Jackson story. He's dead now, so does it matter? Jen is in Washington listening with Shirley. How you doing, Shirley? Hope you're well. Hi to Martin in Spain. Let's crack on. Let's leave Michael Jackson alone. I don't know whether Michael Jackson was guilty of child abuse or not. I have no idea. How could I possibly know? Very, very brief chat about Brexit. The European Union has basically said this afternoon through spokesmen and spokeswomen that there isn't any breakthrough around the Irish backstop. Now, what's the Irish backstop? Well, this was an invention of the European Union and of Remainers. They said that because so many great things have happened on the island of Ireland and we've had peace since the Good Friday Agreement, that there couldn't be a hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland, the Republic, right? So they said a backstop could be put in place that to prevent a hard border, there would be the UK and Northern Ireland would stay in a customs union with the European Union. However, hard Brexiteers said this should be temporary and it should be enshrined in the agreement between the UK and the EU. It should be enshrined in there that it would be temporary. Now, Geoffrey Cox is the UK Attorney General. He's been in Brussels this week, but he's getting nowhere. And today, Sky News and the BBC have been told by government ministers that even if Theresa May secures a deal with the European Union that would be approved by Parliament next week, it wouldn't matter. There's going to be a Brexit delay and an extension of Article 50 anyway. It's the greatest stitch-up of all time. I think you can see that now, even if you're pro-EU, or you might be, I don't know. I can't imagine anyone listening to this programme regularly would want the UK to be in the EU. But it's a massive big stitch-up. It really is. May's deal will be voted down next week, probably. And then there will be an extension of Article 50. We ain't going anywhere. Now, the Labour MP, Chris Bryant, was on Sky News this afternoon. He was on primarily to talk about treatment for skin cancer. And I don't know the man, but good luck to him in his treatment with skin cancer, of course. But Brexit and anti-Semitism came up. Interesting this, because down the line, Chris Bryant might be, when the Blairites eventually take over the Labour Party again, Chris Bryant might be a future leader. Might be. I don't know. Very well-spoken man. Clever guy. A Blairite, I think. I think it's fair to say. And he owes his husband, he's a gay man, he owes his husband, I suppose, some thanks, because it was his husband who noticed that he had a mole on his head. It's this is why he's had treatment for skin cancer. Anyway, on Brexit, this is Chris Bryant, Labour MP.
I don't think the Prime Minister's deal will get through next week, but I'm not a commentator, I'm a player in this, and what I'm trying to do is trying to make sure that, well, in an ideal world, I'd like the voters to have another go and see what they think about where we've got to. Because I don't think Parliament, this Parliament anyway, is in a fine enough state to be able to resolve it.
So he wants the voters to have another go. His colleague Jess Phillips told Adam Bolton this morning that Brexit should be stopped. If she had her way, she would just stop it. To hell with the 52% who voted to leave. What else does Brian say?
I work all the time with other Labour colleagues and Tories and Lib Dems and anybody to try and see a way through this. I think the Prime Minister's been too intransigent. She's not been prepared to listen to others. There would have been another way of doing Brexit, which might have pleased more people.
But she's like you, Christopher. She doesn't want to leave, mate. That's the intransigence you're talking about there.
Might have protected more jobs, but I'm really worried now, like with news from Nissan and companies like this, I'm really, really worried that we are just cutting off our nose to, sorry to introduce a surgery sort of thing, but, you know.
Yeah, Brexit has destroyed industry. Excuse me. Some might say that was a Freudian slip. Membership of the European Union has destroyed industry. It's killed manufacturing, destroyed the car building, car manufacturing industry in this country. It's destroyed agriculture, and it has obliterated or eviscerated the fishing industry. That's what it has done, right? That's what I would say anyway. So, right, so moving then to anti-Semitism. Kay Burley, of course, intrepid, fearless interrogator of politicians, right? Kay couldn't wait to bring up anti-Semitism and Luciana Berger, who had a baby recently, which apparently makes Luciana Berger even more vulnerable than she was as a Jewish woman. Because we all know that Jewish people are unbelievably vulnerable. We have to protect them. We can't speak about them. But a pregnant Jewish woman, well, there isn't enough cotton wool in the world to protect Luciana Berger. So Kay couldn't wait to bring it up as Bryant was saying that he's going to stay in the Labour Party.
In the end, I think the Labour Party is a force for good, and there we have problems. I mean, somebody said to me earlier today that, Chris, you're in better nick than the Labour Party at the moment. And I said, well, I'm certainly in better nick than the government. We've got problems, but I'm very determined to try and sort all of those problems
out. What do you think the biggest problem is? I mean, anti-Semitism is certainly very much front and centre at the moment. Luciana had a baby yesterday, by the way.
Oh, Luciana had a baby yesterday. I love the way Kay asks and answers the question. Shall we hear that again? She's brilliant, Kay, isn't she? Asks and answers the question.
I mean, anti-Semitism is certainly very much front and centre.
But I'm very determined to try and sort all of those problems
out. What do you think the biggest problem is? I mean, anti-Semitism is certainly very much front and centre at the moment. Luciana had a baby yesterday, by the way.
Luciana had a baby. What's Brian supposed to say there? Oh, quick, let's congratulate Jewish MP Luciana Berger and having a baby. And by the way, sincerely, good luck to mother and baby and all of that. Sincerely, by the way. But we have to invoke that, don't we? if you're Kate Burley, you've got to bring it up. What does Brian say?
Yes, I saw a boy, I think, yeah. And I just tweeted to her, I'm delighted for her. I love Luciana. I was at a wedding. It's one of the most joyful events I've ever been to in my life.
Well, you have to love her. She's Jewish.
To my life. Though health and safety, I don't think, really comes into it for Jewish weddings when they're being...
You racist bastard.
...being thrown around on chairs and all of that. You know, I mean, it's terribly depressing to think that a colleague would be effectively... I mean, it feels as if she was pushed, bullied out of the Labour Party. And that's the kind
should
of thing...
Should more have been done to stand up for
oh, yeah,
like
definitely,
her,
of course.
Loads more should have been done. I'll tell you what should have been done. Berger just had to mute or block those who were saying silly things to her on Twitter. That's about the size of it. As for anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, it doesn't exist. And this has been proven time and time and time and time again. But yeah, there is nothing or nobody more vulnerable in the world than a pregnant Jewish woman. Bored to tears with all of this now, but I am going to ask Paul Craig Roberts about it in a minute. 14 minutes now it is past the hour, or 5 o'clock as I speak with you live today. The Bank of England is going to launch a shake-up of the UK's cash system after a report today said it was falling apart. And moving to a cashless society would see millions of people left behind. Indeed, this has come up on my programmes for over 10 years now. A major review has claimed the system is on the verge of collapse, with experts warning the closures of bank branches and cash machines are the tip of the iceberg. Retailers even increasingly going cashless in order to reduce costs. This is terrible, obviously, the implications of a cashless society for your freedom, for your freedom from observation, for your right not to be monitored, number one, and two, to be able to freely engage in commerce with other people without having to use banks or use other financial institutions. It goes beyond all of that. You know this as well as I do. Sky did have a woman on today called Jasmine Bertels. She was very interesting. She's a money and finance expert. And it's rare on commercial or national media for somebody to really lay it on the line. This is good stuff from Jasmine Bertels.
You know, this is something that has been going on for quite some time. And there are countries already that are cashless. Sweden, for example, is completely cashless now. So there is, if you like, a real danger. And I do see it as a danger, actually, that we could follow suit. We could end up with no cash at all, which would not only be difficult for those, largely the older people who really are only used to using cash and even checks still as well. But I think it would also be harmful for the rest of us because cash is anonymous. It's one of the few areas now where we're not totally tracked in everything we do. And it's also a good safety net in case internet systems go down, for example.
Good idea for the government though, isn't it? No black market after that, is there?
Well, yes, and this, you know, there's been a...
Well done, Kay.
There's been quite a concerted campaign against cash globally, actually, over the last 10, 15 years. There have been books written about how only criminals use cash. And, yeah, it's true, absolutely. Criminals use cash because it's anonymous, but then you and I can use it as well. And something that I'm seeing more and more is that data is being mined. Our data is being mined. We are being watched all the time, all sorts of aspects of our lives that we have no idea are being tracked. And of course, every time you use a credit card, every time you use your phone or any sort of device, a sort of digital device to make a payment, that is tracked. It goes into the big data bank. And it gets to a point where, I mean, people like me start to think, really, do I want every single transaction that I make, whether I go to the supermarket or whether I'm getting a tube train or whatever, do I want all of that tracked? I'm not sure that I do. I rather like the idea of just deciding what I spend on the cash that I use and the fact that that isn't really tracked.
Yeah, she was good, wasn't she? Of course, the scariest thing about a cashless society, and I'm not the first person to say this, obviously, is that the system, if you want to call it that, can very easily turn you off, can very easily render you hopeless, render you out of pocket, render you moneyless. And it could be used, of course, to suppress social movements, genuine social movements for genuine change, couldn't it? By basically erasing or deleting the leaders or the communities that might want to stand up and rise up against the establishment, you know? That's what's really scary about it. I won't labour the point because it's been discussed on the programme many times. It is Wednesday's Richie Allen Show. Dr. Paul Craig Roberts has just said hello. That's good news. He'll be on the show in a few minutes' time. Welcome to it, by the way, if you're just joining us. I want to say hi to Michael, who made a donation to the programme today. Very kind donation of £20. Thank you, Michael. He knows who he is. He's listening. Thanks for doing that. He doesn't ordinarily listen live because he couldn't figure out how to do so, which was a bit surprising to me. He listened on demand. But anyway, I sent him some links. It's on TuneIn Radio. It's on the Richie Allen homepage. It's on triggerwarning.tv. And yeah, in this day and age, not being able to find it live. Anyway, I jest. 19 minutes past the hour. What have we got time for before we speak with Paul? There's a couple of other stories I wanted to get into. Knife crime, which has been in the news, of course, all week. And it's been in the news off and on for some time now, because youngsters are getting murdered and others are getting seriously injured by knives and people carrying knives. And there are youngsters going around carrying knives, not because they want to stab anybody, but they're terrified now. This is the trauma effect, you see, of these stories. There are youngsters going around carrying knives in for security in the event that they are challenged. And that's not a good thing either. So Theresa May has not been listening to police concerns about knife crime. And this is according to a former head of the Met Police, a guy called Lord Stevens, who said, "I don't think she listens, quite frankly, to what she's being told." Lord Stevens is speaking to BBC Radio 4. I don't have the audio. I don't have time to play it anyway. But in effect, he said that when she was Home Secretary, that basically she was dismissing out of hand the fact that the police needed more numbers and needed more funding. May is hanging on to this idea. She's sticking to her guns. No, I don't want to be using analogies like that. But she's basically saying that funding is not the issue. However, her Home Secretary, Sajid Javid, has contradicted her and has agreed that funding is indeed an issue. I think he's a very ambitious man, as Javid. He knows that May is dead in the water. And he's got eyes on the prize. He's got eyes on the big job. Here he is contradicting his boss.
I think police resources are very important to deal with this. We've got to do everything we can. I'm absolutely committed to working with the police in doing this. And we have to listen to them when they talk about resources. And that's why with the meeting we have today with police chiefs, these police chiefs represented the seven largest forces with the biggest increases in serious violence, they would all say resources are important, and they've welcomed the £1 billion increase, the almost £1 billion this year, and I'm listening to them on what more we can do.
Ambitious young man, Sajid Javid. Tipped, hotly tipped. I told you on yesterday's programme, the Zionists of Tel Aviv love Sajid Javid. Watch that very closely. I'm not saying it will be him now, it could be Gove. It could even be the wild-haired lunatic that is Bojo, right? Says the man with no hair. Fair enough, fair enough. I'd love Boris's hair. Would I? I don't know. Anyway, watch Javid very closely. Now, we're going to leave this with Sarah Thornton. She's the National Police Chief Council Chairwoman. And they've been asking to be allowed to stop and search whomever they want without being accused of discrimination. You know that the government, of course, in recent years, has made it more difficult for police officers to randomly stop people and ask them to submit to a search. Anyway, the police are saying, we want that right restored to us properly. Here's Sarah Thornton.
So one of the things we did discuss with the Home Secretary is the use of Section 60 which is when a senior officer can say in a certain area, because there's been so much violence, then people can be searched without reasonable grounds. We've had some restrictions on the use of that power for 4 or 5 years, and we discussed the benefit of removing those, and most of the chiefs were in favour of removing those restrictions so that officers are really confident to use their powers, that they know they've got the support of the Home Secretary and the government in using stop and search to help reduce crime.
Sarah Thornton there. That one is a contentious one. I've had many discussions over the years with people like Lee Jasper, who's a black man, a socialist and an activist in London, and others who believe that there has been institutional racism in UK authority organisations, whether it's the police, whether it's other aspects of security. A lot of black men and women believe that black people searched indiscriminately over the years, harassed by the police. And as a white man, I've never had to experience, I don't think I've ever been stopped by a policeman, ever, and asked to empty my pockets or to give my identification or anything like that. I don't know. I think in some areas where knife crime is more prevalent, first of all, there are more black and ethnic minority people living in those areas anyway. So it would be hard not to search more black people and people from other ethnic minority backgrounds, I think. I don't know. I'm sure I'll get a volley of tweets on that and a few emails. It's an interesting one. It's 24 minutes past the hour. Keep the emails coming in. The tweets even. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Rob tweets, they're about to ban crossbows, Richie. Hunger Games, says Rob. Thanks, Rob. A number of you have been tweeting about the cashless society. It is a very serious pillar, I think, of the dystopian society that the financial elites are building. It's obviously a huge building block for them, basically eliminating cash altogether. It gives them ultimate power then to get rid of those whom they might deem to be a threat to them and to their plans. It really is game. You've listened to me long enough. I don't do fear porn. Never have done. I never will do. But if cash is done away with, and we see what's happening in Sweden. Sweden, of course, is the one they mention all the time because it's happening in Sweden. If we eliminate cash, I think it's game over. And again, I don't want to be sounding like a fear monger there. All right. Shall we get Dr. Paul Craig Roberts on? Let's do it. Let's get him on. He is a top man, of course. He's a former US Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. He worked under President Reagan, of course. I know you know all this. We've got to give people their due introductions when they come on the programme. Turn that down, Richie. He's a brilliant man, former US Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. He's an author and he's a great journalist. And you can read him daily on his website, paulcraigroberts.org. That's paulcraigroberts.org. If you haven't checked his website out before, check him out. Not only is the website packed full of brilliant writing by himself, but he hosts a lot of terrific journalists and writers on the site as well. It is paulcraigroberts.org. Do check it out. And please do consider supporting Paul Craig Roberts at paulcraigroberts.org. Right? Let's welcome him back to the programme. It's always a pleasure. Paul, thanks for taking the call again today. How are you?
Just fine, Richie, and I hope you are.
I'm back, Paul. Yeah, I had a rotten time of it this year so far, but serious illness, but I'm back in the saddle, as it were. Thanks for the kind words and the lovely email that you sent me the other day. Loads to talk about. Great stuff on your site this week and every week. I wanted to ask you straight off the bat, though. I've been following very closely the attacks on the Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. Now, I don't know very much about her, and I'm sure I could probably find things that, you know, are not very nice about her and her positions. But isn't it interesting that she talks about being almost harassed into declaring her vocal support for the State of Israel, and how that's not a good thing, that she's there to serve the American people, and she's getting attacked from every angle. I don't suppose even that surprises you one bit, Paul.
I know, not one bit. If I remember correctly, this is the Palestinian woman, or she's someone who expressed concern about what the Israelis were doing to the Palestinians. It was a fairly mild-mannered statement. And of course, since she's a member of Congress, the Israel lobby went berserk because they can't possibly tolerate any member of the House or Senate or anyone in the presidency, the Oval Office, ever saying anything about Israel, no matter what they do. So they have gone into a full frontal attack on her. They're using other members of Congress. They, of course, use the media, which they completely control. And they're trying to shut her up, drive her out of office. She's already had to apologize. So you can see the power of the Israel lobby in the United States, that a member of the House of Representatives says something mildly critical of Israeli behavior toward the Palestinians.
Yeah, and she's hammered.
And she is hammered. So according to the Israel lobby, if you say that the Israel lobby has influence, that means you're an anti-Semite.
Yeah, it's interesting. I thought she was the Palestinian American as well. I made that mistake. She's actually the Somalian American woman. But you're right, there is another woman, and there's also a woman called Ocasio-Cortez. This is interesting, Paul. A few months ago, Ocasio-Cortez, whose Christian name escapes me, she was very critical of when the Palestinians were at the right of return protests and they were being fired at by Israeli snipers. She was very critical of that and said it was basically a disgrace and it was wrong and it was criminal. And funnily enough, this week, all of a sudden, out of the blue, the US mainstream media is questioning her financial contributions and her campaign finances. It's all very timely, I think, but none of this is new to you, Paul. You've been watching this for years. If you say anything about the Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people, you're going to be destroyed.
That's right. In fact, you can't even say that they're influential in the United States government. They can brag about it, and they do. There have been innumerable Israeli prime ministers, other ministers in Israel, also the leaders of AIPAC, the American Israel lobby here, and the ADL, and they all brag about how they have the United States government twisted around their finger and that they can make the United States government do whatever they want, whenever they want, and that everybody in the government's scared to death of them. But if you say it yourself, oh, you're an anti-Semite, you're saying we have influence and power and that we are misdirecting your government. And of course, they can say it, but you can't.
But you can.
In fact, you can't even quote them. If you quote them, you say, okay, here's a quote. This is the Israeli prime minister. The Americans are wrapped around my little finger. Oh, they go berserk. They say, oh, you hate Jews. You want to kill the Jews, blah, blah, blah. So anybody that even acknowledges what they claim themselves or admit themselves is just, they try to wreck you, destroy you. So it's an extraordinary thing, the power that they have over the United States. You know, it's the media, it's the Congress, it's entertainment, it's the financial system, Wall Street, the big banks. It's just amazing that they control the foreign policy in the Middle East. It's just an amazing thing. It's just extraordinary to see. We're supposed to be a superpower and all of that kind of stuff. Well, the United States government can't even stand up to Israel.
Yeah, and well, you're aware, of course, that the Labour Party here is in disarray because we can't go one day without there being new complaints about anti-Semitism in the UK Labour Party, despite the fact there isn't any evidence to back it up. People have been criticising Israel on the left for, well, forever, as you know. And some of them, yeah, they've maybe gone a bit close to the bone, but there's no real epidemic of anti-Semitism. And yet the Jeremy Corbyn, what we would call the front bench, the main players, Jeremy Corbyn, his shadow chancellor, rather than stand up to it in the limited time they have in the spotlight, Paul, they keep apologising forward and agreeing to investigations. When will somebody in a real position of power have the courage to say, no, 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 stop, we will criticise the influence of the Israeli government. We will criticise what the Israeli government does in Palestine. And we're not going to be driven back, or we're not going to fear being called racist. Will anybody ever have the courage to deal with it, to take it on?
I don't think so. I think the Israelis have so much power over the UK and over the United States that you can't stand up to them. It must have been 30 years ago, maybe 40. Admiral Morrow, the chief of naval operations in the United States, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he told me, he said, no American president can possibly stand up to Israel. He was very upset about the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty, where the Navy was forced to cover it up and pretend it was all some kind of a mistake. And he said, if you can't even hold Israel accountable for killing our own sailors, then you're not really a country. So I don't think anybody can do anything about it. But let's just be quite clear what anti-Semitism is. What that it was supposed to mean was that you hated Jews. It was somebody who hated Jews and wanted to do Jews harm. Well, now the Israel lobby and the Israeli government have turned the meaning of the word into anyone who says anything in the slightest way critical about Israel. So you can say that actually you are for Israel and you're trying to protect them, and you think that it's not doing their reputation good to be slaughtering Palestinian women and children and knocking down their homes and olive groves and stealing their land, that this probably isn't good for Israel's reputation and they should stop doing that. If you even say it like that, it means you're now an anti-Semite. So they have broadened the word to mean that you can't say anything about Israel. You can't protest. You can't possibly be part of disinvesting or boycotting Israeli goods. We have 50 states in this country, and 26 of the state governments have passed laws that anyone, any company that in any way participates in a boycott of Israeli goods or disinvest pension funds they manage from Israeli investments, they cannot do business with the state. They're excluded from any contractual arrangements with the state. So this is even at the state level in the United States. More than half the states are now puppets of the Israeli government, and the same legislation is pending in 13 more states. And in the Congress, there's a bill that simply, it appears to criminalize any sort of criticism of Israel or any kind of boycotting or disinvesting from Israeli companies. So this type of power is extraordinary. It's never before seen on the face of the earth.
Never. Let's move away from it anyway. It's local authorities, like local councils here in the UK, doing the same thing, introducing regulations that would prevent the council doing business with anybody who wants to boycott Israel. Dr. Paul Craig Roberts is our guest, folks. Paul, you are genuinely one of the most requested guests on this programme. You really are. You're up there in the top three or four. Listeners always asking me, Richie, get Paul back on. And when you come on, they always send me questions. They've asked me to ask you a little bit about Venezuela. We'll do that, of course, in a minute. They've asked me to put to you, what did you think of the allegations made by Robert Mueller when he testified before Congress, when he said that Trump did give him money to pay to porn stars, when he said that Trump was genuinely racist, that he went through Chicago and said only blacks could live like that. So these are the things my listeners are asking me to put to you. You can talk about what you want. Before Venezuela, what have you made of the Mueller, the sensational appearance of Mueller, of course, Trump's former lawyer, recently? What did you think of all of that, Paul?
Yeah, you're talking about Cohen, the Jewish lawyer that Trump had. Mueller is the special prosecutor.
Oh, excuse me, I'm an idiot. You're right. You were talking about Michael Cohen. Sorry, Paul. You see, I've been out of this. I've been out of the saddle for so long. I'm going crazy.
Gritchie, you're not an idiot.
Michael Cohen, yeah.
You're talking about the Jewish attorney that had done some work for.
Thank you.
For Trump, not about Mueller. So why did he say all that? Well, none of it has anything whatsoever to do with Russiagate. So why did he say that? Well, Mueller tried to do, since there was no such thing as Russiagate, it's a hoax created by the CIA and the FBI, the purpose of which is to stop Trump from normalizing relations with Russia, because the military security complex needs an enemy to justify its $1,000 billion annual budget. Well, so that's the origin of Russiagate. It was made up, and the Democrats jumped on it because it was an excuse for why did Hillary lose? So when Mueller is given this sort of propaganda mission, they know it's a hoax that Mueller himself helped create. It wasn't real. So how could they get anything on Trump? What they did, they picked on people who were his associates, former associates, two of his campaign managers, Manafort and Roger Stone, and our sometime lawyer, Cohen. And so what did they do to them? Well, they looked way in the distant past, and they tried to find something. They usually make up something when you don't have to keep the records beyond 7 years. So they make up something that you can't really contest. And they say, oh, you didn't pay income taxes, or you hid this money, or you did this. And so what they're trying to do is to make you turn state witness against Trump. Since they don't have any evidence against him, they're telling you, we're going to put you in prison unless you make up something about him that you can tell us that we can use against him. So that's what they did. They tried it on Manafort. It didn't work. They're trying it now on Roger Stone. It's not working, but it worked on Cohen. And so what Cohen is doing, he's saying all this stuff, hoping to get a mitigated sentence, to get a sentence reduction, or even to be allowed to walk free. So this is a standard practice of American prosecutors. It's permitted by the judges and the courts. The prosecutors are even permitted to pay a witness.
Yeah.
To come and speak against the defendant. So the system of justice here essentially doesn't exist. It's totally corrupted. And so it can be used in this way. So what does it do? Well, Manafort hopes, it hasn't produced any indictable offenses on Trump's part, but it's more propaganda against him. It blackens his reputation more, and so they hope he won't be able to run for re-election, or if he does, he'll be defeated. So that's about the basis. That's all that remains of Russiagate now. They're trying to blacken Trump with all kinds of extraneous accusations unrelated to Russiagate that will cause the Republicans not to renominate him for re-election, or if they do, for people to desert him so that he doesn't get re-elected. So that's what that's all about. It's not about anything else.
Paul, let me be devil's advocate in the absence. I think you might very well be on to something there, obviously. But in the absence of the other side, wouldn't giving... For our listeners who don't know, Michael Cohen was basically found guilty of tax fraud and of lying. And he's going to be sentenced. He got 3 years in jail, didn't he? Now, wouldn't it be counterproductive for Trump's enemies to show that Cohen got a reduced sentence in return for his testimony against Trump? Trump would be able to use that. So in the absence of any
No. No, in fact, the deal may have already been made. He may have got 3 years instead of 5 years, and it was, or instead of 10 years. You know, he may, the 3 years may be the deal. Okay, we'll only give you 3 years and not 5 or 10, and you have to say these things.
Fair enough.
So the deal may have already been made. On the other hand, what can happen is after a year in jail, the prosecutor can go to the judge and say, we think that he should be released on good behavior.
And yeah.
He was a cooperative witness, and so, you know, he should be...
sent home. Yeah.
Yeah.
These are backroom deals, of course, that are very possible and maybe probable. Before we move to Venezuela, huge interest in this, by the way. Thanks for the tweets, friends. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Paul Craig Roberts, my friend and colleague who's been on programs with me now for some years. You know who Paul is. Go to paulcraigroberts.org if you haven't before. Before we talk about Venezuela, Paul, which is worrying a lot of people, what about the allegations about Roger Stone and Julian Assange and the leaks of the Hillary Clinton emails and Cohen's claim that Trump knew about that and was smugly satisfied that it would help his campaign? That was a very serious allegation.
It's not a serious allegation at all. There's nothing serious about it. It's totally false. But even if it was true, it doesn't mean anything. But it's totally false. We have conclusive proof that there was no hacking of any emails. They were downloaded on a thumb drive in the Democratic National Committee's headquarters. And they were released on a thumb drive. We know that for a fact because we have it from William Binney, who designed and operated the entire spy system for the National Security Agency. We have it from all the top CIA whistleblowers. They have looked at this and they have proven conclusively that it was downloaded so quickly it could not possibly have been done over the internet.
Thanks for knocking that out of the park, by the way.
There's no known technology, no one has it, that could have downloaded all that in the speeds that it shows that it was downloaded. So it went on thumb drive, and it was that guy, you remember the American employee there who got mysteriously shot down in the street and they can't figure out why he's dead and who murdered him? That's the guy who downloaded it on the thumb drive. And it was released in that way, and that's how WikiLeaks got it. WikiLeaks has said over and over and over, did not come from Russia, did not come from Trump. There's been proved conclusively that Roger Stone has never been in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. You know, you can't go in that embassy without being cameraed. And,
of course,
and
yeah.
And you have to turn over your passport and everything else. You just read John Pilger's description of his recent meeting with Assange in the embassy, what he had to go through just to get in. And he couldn't have anything. He couldn't even have his passport. He had to leave it with the counter and all that. So all of this is just utter total bullshit. It's made up nonsense. It relies on the fact that most people in the world just don't know how things work. And it sounds like some sort of something they would have seen in a James Bond movie or something. And so they think it might be real.
We're living in a post-fact world, Paul. You were referring to the murder, of course, of the staffer, the DNC staffer, Seth Rich.
Seth Rich. He was murdered because he's the one who downloaded the files on a thumb drive and released them to whoever that they got to WikiLeaks. There's no doubt about it.
By the way, Paul, thanks for knocking that one out of the park. I had to ask you that, even though Bill Binney was on this program last year saying word for word what you said there about the technology needed to do that. And I'm no fan of Donald Trump or of Hillary Clinton or any of them, but I believe in being honest and telling the truth. Final question on this, Paul, from Patricia, who's an Irish-American living in Switzerland at the moment and a long-time listener to this programme. Does Dr. Roberts think that Felix Slater's testimony will prove any collusion between Trump and Russia? Will that give us any more? What's that going? I know what you're going to say, but she's asked the question. Felix Slater, will he throw any grenades into the room? What do you think?
Well, I don't know if they've got something on him and they can get him to tell lies. Who knows? But, you know, the thing is, anybody can say anything, but if there's no evidence, it can't be it can't be of any effect. I mean, anyone can say anything, but there's no evidence. And not only that, what does it matter if Trump spoke to Putin or somebody else? I mean, you're supposed to speak to them. See what they're doing. It shows how everybody gets sucked into this. If you say hello to a Russian, you're being criminalized. It means you're a traitor. If you're a diplomat or you are the national security advisor who's been appointed, like General Flynn, and you're doing what everyone has always done who was appointed to that position, you contact the Russian ambassador and you make his acquaintance and you establish relations so you can communicate. You're supposed to do that. Well, now that's, oh, he's a Russian agent. You see what they do? They criminalize the normal expected behavior.
It's McCarthyism in the 21st century.
Everybody should have the sense to see that's all this is about.
And that's your cat weighing in with an agreement there. I think your cat is giving you your thumbs up, Paul. Right, we're going to leave that one there, and we'll talk a little bit about Venezuela, which I've been covering extensively. Had quite a lot of people come on the program recently since I came back talking about it, and they're convinced that some sort of action against Venezuela might very well be imminent. Even it's fighting in Venezuela through the use of proxy forces. Are you dismayed by the kind of hawkish attitude towards Venezuela by the US government and Trump? Did you see that coming this year? What do you think of what's been happening there?
Well, you know, it's not a hawkish attitude. It's a totally illegal effort to overthrow a duly elected democratic government and install an American puppet. It's another seizure of a country. It's a theft. It's an attempted theft of Venezuela by the United States. That's what it is. It's just like Saddam Hussein. They set him up. Oh, weapons of mass destruction. Of course, they were lying through their teeth, as was your prime minister, that piece of crap, Tony Blair. Then it's Gaddafi, all the lies about Gaddafi. And then it's Assad, chemical weapons. And it's Iran, nuclear weapons. And so what is it about Maduro? Oh, he's starving the people. Well, we've had a number of people go through all the grocery stores in Venezuela, and they're just overflowing with stuff, and there's nobody starving. And so the aid that the Americans claim that they want to send aid, the Americans have stolen $21 billion from Venezuela. And so they want to give them $21 million in aid. They've stolen $21 billion. Why don't they give the money back? They stole. And what is this aid? It's a bunch of arms and ammunition and bazookas pretending to be aid. And where is it going? Well, that's a good question, because the country overwhelmingly supports the Venezuelan government. All the polls show that. Who's opposed to him? The tiny little Spanish elite who have, before Chavez, ruled the country in keeping with Washington and joined in with the Americans in looting and plundering the country, the oil and all the rest. And what did Chavez do? He nationalized the oil and turned it to the use, the revenues of it, to the use of the people. And that's what Maduro is doing. Well, they want the companies back. So this is a coup organized by Washington to steal the country, stick in a puppet who has never even run for president. But the Americans have announced, oh, he's now the president. I mean, why don't I announce that I'm the president or something like that, you know? So they go get him in there, and then he's going to privatize the oil companies, and they're going to go back to ExxonMobil and BP or whoever had them before. and they're going to loot the country like they were doing before. The entire history of Latin America is to be looted by the Americans. They have never tolerated any independent government. Look at all the coups. I mean, I think I saw the other day there have been 68 times we've overthrown governments down there because they elected a reformer who represented the people. We don't stand for it. Look, Obama threw out the reformist elected president of Honduras in 2009. We managed to change the government in Ecuador. And we now have our man in there, and that's threatening Julian Assange's asylum. We overthrew the woman a few years ago who was the president of Argentina. We overthrew the woman who was president of Brazil. We frame them up. We bring false charges. Why our charges have the effect of law in Argentina and Brazil is a question the world should be asking. And so we get them out. So we don't tolerate any reformer anywhere in Latin America. There's never been one that survived. Chavez survived the longest. In fact, we actually overthrew him. I think it was
2002,
yeah, we overthrew him. He was captured. But before we could kill him, the military and the people took the streets and demanded his release. And we had to turn him loose. Now, the mistake all of these reformers make, including Chavez, and Maduro is making it now, they never take action against the criminal elites that they replace. They leave them there.
Why, Paul?
I don't know whether they don't have enough power or whether they are actual Democrats and believe in political competition. But you see, Chavez left them even after they conspired against him, overthrew him, and were about to kill him. He gets freed by his own people. He's again the president. He took no actions against them. They're still there, the same ones. They still control the entirety of the media in Venezuela, the economy. And the fact that nothing has ever happened against them is why they are now operating with us against Maduro. Now look, this guy we picked, Juan, whatever his name is.
Guaido, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, he goes in and out. He flew into the airport the other day in Venezuela. He's not picked up and arrested. There's no doubt whatsoever he's guilty of sedition, high treason. He is a prime candidate for trial and execution. And Maduro doesn't even pick him up. So this kind of weakness, this has always been the case. Every time these countries elect a Democrat who will represent the people, he leaves the established power entrenched.
And maybe, Paul.
They overthrow it every time with us.
Maybe there's a reason why Maduro didn't have Juan Guaido arrested. Maybe he thinks that he's being baited to do something like that. I agree with you. Why wouldn't you pick the man up, put him on trial for sedition, and then, I'm no fan of capital punishment, I'd bang him up for 30 years and he'd serve 20. I would do that, undoubtedly. But maybe Maduro thinks, well, I'm being baited here in the glare of the international media to do something that gives them an excuse.
Bullshit.
Oh, Paul, come on, it's not. Hang on a second.
They don't need an excuse. Look what they've already done. They don't need an excuse. And what he's doing is showing such weakness that the Venezuelan military may crack because we have tremendous pressure on them.
Yeah.
We're threatening them, we're bribing them, we're offering the generals millions of dollars, and they're sitting there, and they see Maduro won't even pick up the guy who's our agent in overthrowing the government and the one causing them all the trouble. It's this lack of any sign of confidence or firmness. And the lack of confidence it implies on Maduro's part is going to crack his military.
Let me give you an argument against that now, because I hear you loud and clear and I respect what you said. Let me give you an argument against that. You're right to say they don't need any excuse. Of course you are. But I think the presence of Russia, I know it's thousands of miles away, and some of the strong words of condemnation from China and Russia might be a factor here. And maybe Maduro is saying, right, they are desperate to come into the country one way or the other and get rid of me. But if I go after this guy Guaido and lock him up and put him in jail and charge him, that might be the spark, the catalyst. Because until now, maybe, the United States is maybe just holding back just a little bit because of the encouragement and the support that Venezuela has gotten from Russia. That's all I would say, Paul, in defense of Maduro.
Well, they're not holding back anything. If you're talking about an invasion, there have been a lot of the American generals that said, what are you going to do, give us another Vietnam, yeah, another Afghanistan? Well, what are you going to do that for? So, the notion that we're going to invade and just walk in that place and it'll all be over, that's far-fetched.
Crazy, yeah.
It's a crazy idea. And particularly if the country's going to resist. Now, if they lose confidence in Maduro, they resist, because where are they going to get the confidence from? If you're being offered millions of dollars and threatened otherwise, and your leader doesn't do anything but act like a pussy, then you're going to lose confidence. So I think that these reformists have always made the same mistake, and that's why none of them have ever survived.
You make a very good point there, because as you're saying that, I'm imagining there must be generals in the Venezuelan army who must be angry with Maduro that they've not been allowed to arrest Juan Guaido. There might be division there. That's the kind of thing that can fester and cause problems, maybe, as you said, that perceived lack of leadership. It was interesting that when he arrived home, Juan Guaido, he was welcomed by, I think he was welcomed by the French ambassador, which was a bizarre set of circumstances, really.
No, he was surrounded by the French, the German,
yeah,
the others.
Diplomats, yeah.
They were there to be sure that they could make a scene if he was to be arrested. And now the German ambassador has been asked to leave the country because of this direct interference in the political affairs of Venezuela. You see, they don't mind interfering in the affairs, but there's nothing in the American media that, hey, look, we're talking about Russia somehow interfering. Well, look how we're interfering in Venezuela. We are actually, usually when the United States overthrows somebody in a coup, they try to disguise it, to hide it. But this is blatant, open. This is so blatant and so open. There's no disguise. There's no hiding. It's not like that Maduro and this Juan, whoever he is, had an election and that they're claiming Maduro stole the votes from the other guy. The other guy wasn't in the election. He's never run. He's just somebody we said is the president. It makes no sense, does it?
It's a farce, yeah.
It make for the United States to announce who's the president of Venezuela?
It's an utter farce, of course. And sadly, if you're not reading...
Well, why isn't the criticism on the United States?
Yeah, there
why
isn't any.
Why isn't on Maduro?
Well, the European Union backed the United... Yeah, yeah.
Everybody has been brainwashed by Washington. They can't even think.
These are, I don't know, do you get the sense, you're a bit older than I am, a bit more experienced, do you get the sense that we're approaching some sort of critical mass point in our history, that if things don't change, Paul, that they might be irreversible? Does that ever occur to you? I mean, is there a man or a woman alive that, or a party that you could put in that would stop what we're seeing happening year in, year out?
How would you put them in?
Yeah. Exactly.
You got a completely brainwashed population. There was a poll the other day, I think I posted it, or I'm about to. Something like 76% of the American people are now convinced that Russia is a dangerous enemy.
Imagine that.
Imagine that. Yeah. This is a success of propaganda. It's far more successful than Goebbels ever had in National Socialist Germany. Here is the complete takeover of the American mind, the European mind, by American propaganda. And so, again, I want to ask the question. Here's the United States. If they pick somebody out of nowhere and claimed he's the president because the American government said he was. Now, so what is the criticism of Maduro? Why? The criticism belongs on Washington. And where is the criticism of Washington for doing this? It's only Russia and China. But, but they're our enemies. We can't believe them. So you can see, when you have a mindless population, which is all the United States has, it's all England has, it's all Europe has, they're mindless, they're brainwashed.
I can't blame them though, Paul. I'm like yourself, I'm a real journalist. And I served my apprenticeship and I worked with really good people, good journalists who asked questions and who uncovered scandals and who held politicians to account. You grew up reading men and women who exposed this crap, but now there's only you and a handful of others exposing it. I don't blame people. People anger me just as much as they anger you because of their sheepishness, but they're exposed to nothing else but lies and propaganda on a daily basis. And you're striving to do what you're doing. I mean, you've got a great profile, the jobs that you've had, Paul, your website is excellent, paulcraigroberts.org, but you struggle for funding. And it's difficult to reach people. They get their information from organisations that lie to them day in, day out. I've great sympathy for people. I'm not saying you don't, but I don't know what we need to do more to change that. We're nearly out of time for today anyway. If you haven't read Paul's website before, and I know pretty much my audience, they knew all about Paul before they knew about me. PaulCraigRoberts.org, if you haven't read Paul before, check him out. Daily articles there. Paul also gives a platform to other men and women writing interesting articles, writing challenging pieces, you know, saying the things that are not being said on Fox, on CNN, or on the BBC here in the UK. I'm going to give you the final word today, Paul, as usual. Thanks for coming back, by the way. I know you're in great demand all the time. Final word, give us a little bit of optimism before we part company today. There isn't any.
Well, you know, I think the only optimism is that it looks like Putin and the Russian government have finally caught on. That the greatest concentration of evil that has ever existed in the world is in the UK government, in the US government, in the Israeli government. And so he's starting to see that, what is this stuff about our partners? And clearly they don't respect any agreement. Why am I trying to make agreements and negotiate? I'm just going to build up the military. That might sober up the Europeans, since if the Americans actually do manage to get them involved in a conflict with Russia, they won't be there in 5 minutes. So maybe they'll sober up. Maybe they'll finally say, hey, why are we getting pushed into our total annihilation by the Americans? And if that ever happened, then the Americans wouldn't have the forward bases to be threatening Russia. And we could step back from this looming nuclear annihilation, which we're all facing because of the Americans and because of the complicity of the ignorant, stupid Europeans and British in the American aggression toward Russia. So that's the only optimism. Putin has finally realized you can't deal with these people. All they do is lie and break every agreement. What am I calling them partners for? They're clearly our deadly enemies. And maybe the Europeans will say, oh, wait a minute now, he's changed tune. We can't fool him any longer. And so we got to do something about these Americans. They're going to get us all wiped off the face of the earth. That's the only optimism I see. There's none other, because what we're really facing is a conflict in which there won't be any survivors.
Paul, thanks for that. again, I recommend folks paulcraigroberts.org if you haven't been on to Paul's website before. And I say this with the utmost sincerity. When you use websites like Paul's and you get information, useful information from websites like Paul's, as you will do, if you are in a position to donate a couple of bucks, do so. It's the only way that the independent media will endure, the only way the truly independent media will endure. You have to support it. Paul, it's always great to have you on. I know you'll be back real soon again, with your permission. Enjoy the rest of your day there, and I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Okay, Richie, and you're part of the important media too. Don't forget yourself.
Now you're a gent.
So don't get sick again.
No, thanks for saying that, Paul. Really appreciate that. Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, live on the line from his home in Virginia today. Great to have him back on the program there. Pulling no punches there. Yeah, maybe the Russian military build-up will give a moment of pause, at least to the governments and intelligence agencies of Israel, the United States and the United Kingdom. I have no idea. Thanks to Paul. Thanks for the comments coming in on Twitter. I'll get to a couple of them in a minute. Before I do that, though, let's take a very brief pause for the headlines. Let's get the news headlines from FSN. Why not? It's usually Ollie Barrett there. 30-second headlines from FSN. Back with more after these.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. New data shows the US trade deficit soared last year with the rest of the world to a 10-year high. South Korean intelligence believes North Korea is rebuilding a rocket launch site. The United Nations Human Rights Chief has called on France to fully investigate the authorities' use of force during Yellow Vest demonstrations. And singer R. Kelly has denied sexual abuse charges in his first interview since being granted bail.
Thanks, Ollie. It's coming up for 9 minutes past six as I speak with you live on The Richie Allen Show. 9 minutes past the hour, if you're listening to a repeat, of course. Don't get excited. It's not really that time. I'm Richie Allen, live on Fab Radio 2, triggerwarning.tv, richieallen.co.uk, multiple sources as well. The programme can be downloaded on iTunes, Spotify, it's on YouTube, and it's hosted at podomatic.com. There's nearly 4 years of archive Richie Allen shows, 1,000 shows nearly, on podomatic.com, going way back to early 2015. Thanks for your continued support. Back in a few seconds with plenty more. Dr. Stuart Waiton, PhD, will join the program in a few minutes' time. You don't want to miss him.
The Richie Allen Show relies on your support. Go to richieallen.co.uk and set up a monthly donation today.
Yes, indeed, the tweets, and there were lots of them. A lot of you speculating on the reasons, or speculating as to the reason that Maduro, that is Nicolas Maduro, the president, the righteous president of Venezuela, why when Juan Guaido, the imposter, arrived back in Caracas the other day, why did he not find himself under arrest? Well, as Paul Craig Roberts said there, he was greeted when he disembarked the plane by German and French senior diplomats there to make a big show for the international media. Maybe that gave Maduro a moment of pause. And maybe he said, well, maybe my enemies are looking for an excuse to demonise me again, to say that I'm detaining people wrongfully and that I'm a tyrant and all the rest of it. Loads of comments on this. Hi to Patrick, who says, brainwashing and propaganda is rife. He agrees with Paul. I ask again, how do we combat it? Have we got to be patient forever and to the grave? One of the ways we combat it, and you might say, well, you would say this, Richie, is you've got to support the independent media. I'm going to be writing an article in the next couple of days about this particular programme and about the tax returns for this programme over the last 2 years, which are a matter of public record. You don't have to be a genius to find them. But I'm going to show you just how difficult it is, despite the audience size of this programme, how difficult it is to finance it. It's becoming incredibly difficult. And when you find a programme or a publication that you believe in your heart of hearts to be genuine, to be thoroughly independent, and to be putting out information that is in the public interest, you have to support it. Now, this programme will never be put behind a firewall. I will never close it off and charge for it. I will never do that. But I will continue to ask for your help in putting it on. That's what I will do. But it will never be behind a firewall. If things keep going the way they're going, I can see later this year or early next year, I will retire and I will go back to working in the private sector. It's becoming very difficult to do it because the support is not there. It just isn't there. And it's not just me either. Again, I'm going to write something about that in the next few days when I have the time to do it, to explain what's going on with this programme and how difficult it is, as I said, to put it on the air. But I'm not soliciting for donations, and those of you who have donated to the programme in the past and who do currently donate to the programme, don't donate anymore. I'm speaking specifically to people who listen religiously and who have never sent a donation, never, for whatever reason. And that listener is in the majority, because 97% of those who listen to this programme have never made a contribution to it. And that has got to change in the future, okay? Like I said, I'm not, you know, fear-mongering about the show here. This show will go on through 2019. But in 2020, with the current level of funding, what did we declare last year? And we declared everything. It was under £20,000 that came in total. That was last year. I can prove that. It's a matter of public record. The year before, it was £24,000. Think about that. That's before I pay for the hosting of the programme, for the streaming of it, for the podcasting of it. It's absolutely untenable. So if something doesn't change this year, in 2020, I'll be saying, listen, it was brilliant for the last 5 years, but I'm going to go and work in the private sector. And that's not a threat, by the way. I'm just saying that's the way it is. It's very difficult. People, I don't think people are mean. I don't think they're mean-spirited. I don't think they're bastards. They just take it for granted. Well, I get 5 live radio shows a week produced to the utmost highest standard. And they just get used to it and get used to downloading it and listening to it. And don't think for a minute, well, how has he done that on his own with no producers? How has he managed to do that? How has he managed to put those guests on the air, to edit that audio, to present a BBC standard radio programme? How has he done that? Well, at a cost to me, of course. And I don't have any advertising. YouTube deleted my channel over a year ago with nearly 100,000 subscribers. They demonetized it. They will not allow me to monetize my videos now. As you know, there are no ads on them. So that's where it's going. So I'll write something about this in the next few days, and then I'm never going to speak about it again until 2020. And if in early 2020, 12 months from now, it hasn't increased the funding, the donations haven't increased, I won't complain about it. I won't bitch about it. I won't be angry about it. I'll just take a job in the private sector. And that's what you have to do. Right? And it's not just me. People like Paul and people like others. Right, it's time to take some music and to dial up the brilliant Dr. Stuart Waiton. Stereophonics. And Stuart has just weighed in there on Skype. Thank you, Stuart. That's a bit of a relief, that, isn't it? Thanks to Patricia. I'm not guilty about asking for donations, Patricia. I'm a bit childish about it. I don't like having to do it. Music from Stereophonics on The Richie Allen Show. It's exactly 18 minutes past the hour. A huge amount of tweets on Paul Craig Roberts. Thanks for tweeting. As I said before, if you haven't read Paul's website before, it's paulcraigroberts.org. Former assistant Secretary of the Treasury under Ronald Reagan, regular guest on this programme, and he was in explosive form a little bit earlier on. The BBC, by the way, is reporting as I speak that there's been another stabbing in London this evening or this afternoon, and that it's a fatal one, which is not nice. We were speaking about this earlier on and the approaches to it. Maybe our next guest who's been on the programme before and a friend of ours, maybe he might have a comment on that. But I want to talk to him a little bit about free speech and freedom of speech. Before we introduce him, you'll know by now that various people, various commentators on the alt-right, for want of a better way of putting it, on the alt-left, have had YouTube channels deleted and Facebook pages deleted and Twitter accounts banned for saying things that have been deemed offensive to others. I couldn't agree with it. I've never agreed with it, regardless of what I felt about those being banned. This was in the Independent today. The Independent, sadly, is no longer in print. It's online only now, independent.co.uk. And it's a story about a Conservative councillor who's been banned, suspended, because he shared a post on Twitter which protested the banning of Tommy Robinson from Facebook. So just to get this right, a guy called Andrew Bowles on Swale Borough Council, the leader of the council, no less, tweeted that he didn't agree with, he retweeted something expressing dismay that Robinson had been banned from Facebook and Instagram, and because of that, he's now been suspended. These are scary times. Our next guest, no stranger to you because he's been on before, he's a sociologist and a criminologist. He lectures at, he's also an author, he's written some very interesting books. He lectures at Abertay University. I'll tweet out links to where you can read more about him. Without further ado, let's get him back on the programme. Welcome back, Dr. Stuart Waiton. Stuart, thanks so much for giving us your time. How are you?
Yeah, not bad, not bad. Yourself?
I'm really well after a difficult winter, yeah, illness-wise. I'm all right, mate. Thanks for coming back. I love reading you. I love listening to you. This is a very serious issue. It's not a joke. It's hard for me to understand this, having grown up in an environment where people could say what they felt, regardless of whether we agreed with it or not. And, you know, it was good that people got things off their chest and we argued and all of that. That a councillor would be suspended because he tweeted something along the lines of that he agreed that it was wrong for Tommy Robinson to be kicked off Facebook. It's not fear-mongering for me to say this is dystopia, isn't it? It is.
Well, it's not good. Well, it's funny. I was in a... my university does this thing called the thinking module, and basically they set up debates. And my kind of nemesis organises this. So we had a debate about freedom of speech yesterday. So I was defending the motion, which was freedom of speech is absolute. And that's the point of freedom of speech. And he was arguing the opposite. But I think he, I'll not mention his name, but he, I think, is a perfect representation of the modern elite. And from his perspective, I raised the Tommy Robinson thing, and his head sort of explodes regularly, and he starts screaming. This is, you know, there's about 130 students or something in this debate. Tommy Robinson, he is scum. He is scum. He's the scum of the earth. We must stamp down on the scum of the earth and keep him in the gutter where he belongs. And he's a very interesting character because in his imagination, he thinks that the British public are a kind of fairly ignorant, bigoted, racist bunch of people who are a kind of cigarette paper away from stepping back into the 1930s. And he often raises this thing about the 1930s, the spectre of Hitler, and if you allow people like Robinson freedom of speech and so on. So he's a very interesting character to just to watch his kind of loathing, as I see it, of ordinary people. Because essentially, when you talk about Tommy Robinson as scum, what he's really saying is, you, the audience, you know, I don't trust you to listen to what this guy has to say. He's dangerous. You're dangerous. And people like me really need to be determining what you can and can't read on Facebook or anywhere else for that matter. So, yes, it's an interesting it's an interesting subject.
This goes back to a conversation you and I had before about the attempt to protect people from hearing stuff that might cause them consternation. I mean, how can any learned man or woman conclude that it even matters if Tommy Robinson is scum? Whether he is or whether he isn't is obviously highly subjective, number one. And number two, even if he is, He's a human being. Yeah. He came to think the way he thinks for whatever reason he did. Yeah. And as a human being, he has a human right to be heard. And then we have a human right to say, well, you're a Muppet man, and I'll tell you why, right?
Yeah. Well, it is, but that's the problem, is that I think you have to have quite a positive view of people to hold your opinion. And I think what history has taught a certain group of people, especially people from the left. So my colleague, I mean, I'm from the left, my colleague's from the left, but all the lessons he's learned is that, well, actually, people are stupid because they vote for Thatcher. You know, it's right. Like they do what the sun tells them. If the sun says such and such, because they have to find explanations for why the ideas that they liked when they were young didn't come true, why it seems to be a different world to that. And that the ultimate explanation they come to is that you can't trust the people. The people make bad choices. But this has been, I mean, this is a long time. This is 1974, I think it was, when the National Union of Students first supported a no platform of fascists. And that was, interestingly, it was Trevor Phillips.
Was it?
He was the chair of although he said at the time, he says that, you know, it wasn't a big thing for him. It was just something that someone was passing, blah, blah. And he kind of like gave it the nod. But yeah, so at the time, Trevor Phillips was, I think, president of the National Union of Students and supported that motion. So that's, you know, you're talking nearly what, 50 years ago, virtually, that kind of people on the left in students. And that's, you know, you can kind of see the trends of what's coming if you look at student politics to a certain extent, which, you know, when you look at this kind of snowflakery at the minute, is quite terrifying.
And what's incredible about speaking to you, and it's why I love you coming on, is that you're right there. I mean, I do know one or two people personally outside of, I've gotten to know you through the show, obviously, but I don't know you personally. But I do know one or two people who have recently worked in academia, lectured in Manchester, lectured elsewhere, and they're pretty fascinated by what they're seeing as well. The Trevor Phillips thing is really interesting. Thanks for sharing that with me, because Phillips, to his credit, wrote in The Sun, ironically, a few months ago, and he talked about knife crime. Interestingly, we're talking about it today. And Phillips was very much saying that we shouldn't be scared about talking about ethnicity. We shouldn't be worried about being called bigoted because we talk about certain cultural things that might be going on. And because he was the Equality Commissioner, I thought, very good. So maybe Trevor Phillips has had a change of heart since his union days, maybe.
I wouldn't trust his principles particularly, but on that question he is interesting. And I mean, I've seen him talk a couple of times, but one of the ways that it's discussed now, and which is a slight change in terms of the arguments that use, is that they talk about the problem of, if you allow people like Tommy Robinson to speak, if you sit on a platform with them or anything like that, you're helping, it's called, you're mainstreaming his views, right? And this is a discussion now. In fact, the ex-head of the counter-terrorism organization, who sort of resigned and said, oh yeah, the big threat we should all be worried about is the far right, not Islamicists and all that, despite the body count being something like 150 to one. Nevertheless, that was his kind of take. So it's quite interesting that people in quite elite positions in society seem to be more scared about their own population becoming a kind of mob than actual threats that exist. And again, I think the knife crime thing is interesting in that respect, that there's a kind of, it's a bit like the grooming gang discussion or lack of discussion, which is there's a real anxiety to try and have an honest discussion, you know, and to try and look at, well, actually, is this, you know, is there something about a multicultural policy that's being problematic here? I mean, one of the things I wonder is whether white professionals, teachers, people who deal with young people, feel uncomfortable about asserting their authority over young black men. You know, because it's kind of, well, it's their culture, you know, and who am I to criticize their culture? And it's almost like I feel that there's an adult authority vacuum potentially around young black men who are kind of, you know, they're almost, you know, that's let to get on with it themselves because we've become too embarrassed. You know, it's like, can I really tell him how to behave? You know, can I really say this to this person? It's like, is it my place? So I do wonder about that. I do wonder if that's part of the explanation of what's happening, as well as, I think, a sort of sense of victim entitlement. Because society, I think, if I was a young black guy today, I think I would think the world around me is all racist because I keep being told that it is. Now, I'm not convinced that that's true, anywhere near to the extent that that is promoted. But if the way that is promoted, there's a, you know, potential kind of slightly two fingers, narcissistic type of character might be being created by the anti-racist industry that seems to exist in all institutions and most kind of politicians' minds at the minute.
Industry is a really interesting way of putting it. By the way, you mentioned there young black men. There was a fascinating piece in one of the Sunday papers recently about the knife crime. And it was a very well-written piece. I can't, for the life of me, remember which paper it was in. But it was thought-provoking and it was fair. And it just talked about in some of the inner city areas where there might be a problem with violence, that in some cases, you know, a lot of these young men are grown up without dads. And it went into a bit of detail about that. And if I remember, the writer was pilloried online for an ancient trope about blacks not having responsibility for their kids and about black men more likely to leave the home. Now that's, excuse my French, that's bollocks anyway. And it certainly was not what the journalist was saying at all. You know, broken families and couples not staying together. There's an epidemic of that right across the spectrum. I come from a family where my parents broke up when I was 14, 15 years of age. So again, it was an interesting area of investigation the journalist wanted to get into, but was then kind of attempted to be destroyed because, oh, you're saying that the blacks aren't loyal to their families and they run off. And of course, there was nothing like that in there at all. By the way, since we last spoke, and genuinely, this is not about me because I'm not important, but you talk about mainstreaming ideas. This programme was in all the Sunday newspapers a couple of weeks ago because I interviewed a guy called Alex Scott Samuel, who's a Labour guy, who didn't like the Jewish MP Luciana Berger because he felt she was attacking Jeremy Corbyn all the time. So the crux of the articles in the Mail on Sunday and in The Guardian was that by coming on this programme, Samuel had to be some kind of closet racist, because I've interviewed people like David Duke in the past and white supremacists, which I have, Stuart, but I've argued with them. You know, I've not brought them on to agree with them and to have a drink over the campfire. I've attacked their ideas just for a bit of a punch up, because it's good radio. But no, if you go on the Richie Allen Show, you've got to be some sort of racist. Yeah. It's pathetic. I wrote to the paper, I wrote to all of them, I got no response back. I said, listen, Oprah Winfrey interviewed David Duke, so therefore, should people not go on to Oprah Winfrey? Because Oprah is mainstreaming the ideas of David Duke. Oprah did a very good job when she interviewed Duke, as did Phil Donahue. They went after his ideas. This is scary for me, Stuart, because I'm an old school presenter. I talk to anybody, you know? I don't care what their bloody ideas are. Back to you. These crazy times.
No, it's absolutely true. It's well, it's my colleague somehow managed to seem as if he was promoting John Stuart Mill in this debate yesterday. The reality is, I mean, John Stuart Mill made quite a nice argument. It was along the lines of, if there were a million people arguing one position and one person arguing another position, it would still be wrong to stop that one person arguing. And in fact, he says, it would be doubly wrong, because you need to have that person to argue against, because then you can test out your own ideas. Then you can develop your own ideas, you can improve them, and you can have, as part of that discussion, you create a kind of an active public who recognise that their voice needs to be heard. So, and that's one of my concerns. One of the weird things, I think, today is that we live in a world that is obsessed with racism and anti-racism. But I'd be very surprised if there's that many people having genuine arguments and discussions about racism. And what you would want, I think, is you would want to have the public constantly involved in debates of this matter, right? Discussions about what they think, what they think about immigration, what they think about, you know, what they think about race and culture and so on. And that's how you get a properly informed, dynamic public, not by every time, you know, you go near a racist or someone with dodgy views, as most people would say it, you get absolutely slammed for it. So I totally agree with you. I think it's horrendous. And my colleague is, he tries to do this with me. He tries to paint me, calls me a right-wing libertarian. There's nothing right-wing about me, and I've never called myself a libertarian, even though I support kind of liberal freedoms and stuff. Yeah. But that's his kind of thing. And it's incredibly dangerous.
I was just going to say that, sorry to interrupt you, you took the words out of my mouth. It is dangerous because we've seen in the States and we've seen in the UK, I think in English institutions, we've seen attempts to have people removed from their job because they've liked a tweet or because they've said something. That is dangerous. That's beyond dangerous. That's why I invoked dystopia earlier on. Do you sometimes think, I got to be careful here, Stuart,
this poor guy, I'm giving him a hard time. I haven't named him, so that's all right. But, you see, because I was getting flack because I wrote an article about questioning why is there all these girls trying to transition in schools?
Yeah.
And trying to explain what that was about. And the LGBT group at my university put out a petition and tried to get kind of people rallying to say that, you know, something must happen to me, I must be re-educated and so on. And then I wrote an article about the rape law that's changing in Scotland, because now if you're found not guilty in a criminal court, the Scottish government have a special pot which allows the woman to then take you to court through the civil court and claim up to £100,000 on the balance of probabilities.
And so, is the balance of proof less in a civil court, less difficult for...
Yeah, it's 51%.
Wow, right. Yeah, I didn't know the actual statistic.
Yeah, it's the balance of probabilities, you don't have a jury. You just have the judge. So I was saying, well, this seems extremely problematic. This is in essence, even if it's not in absolute legal speak, this is the equivalent of being put on trial twice for the same crime or non-crime, which you've just been found not guilty for suddenly, and it's paid for by the government. Anyway, so I wrote an article about that, and my esteemed colleague came in and said, you know, this is, you know, shocking, blah, blah. You know, if I would be surprised if you got sacked from this university, you wouldn't get another job in another university, and you'll have brought it on yourself.
That's disgraceful, Stuart.
Brought it on yourself. It is disgraceful. And what's just what I find horrible about it and really worrying is that not only, you know, because you're able to wrap this up and say, oh, it's like I'm against Nazis and I'm against Tommy Robinson and all the rest of it. But really, you know, once you start there, it's really actually... You're against lots of things, really, aren't you? You really don't like people expressing opinions that you don't agree with. You know, so you know, it's not just realistically, it's not just Tommy Robinson that people want to close down. It's many, many, many more people than that, and in fact, many academics who don't fit the correct mold.
Yeah, I remember Norman Finkelstein's a friend of mine. He's been on my programs for years. And this happened to him in the States many years ago because he wrote a book that said that, you know, his mum and his aunt were at Auschwitz, unimaginable, of course. And he wrote a book saying the Holocaust industry, which is a very powerful book, saying that the state of Israel has used what happened to Jews in Nazi Germany, has used it in a very malevolent way. And I'm obviously but I'm not giving a great synopsis of the book. And he was destroyed for it. And, you know, it was a very strong opinion. I'm sure some Jews were cheesed off by it, fair enough. But he was ultimately destroyed for saying what, you know, a lot of Orthodox Jews and a lot of Jews on the left would say, yeah, well, we have. We have poisoned the memory of people who died by doing what we've done in Gaza and elsewhere, and one thing and another. And he was destroyed. I really worry about that. I worry about this programme. I've been told that, you see, I come from mainstream radio, Stuart, from commercial radio, and I've got a lovely state-of-the-art studio here in Manchester, and I do this live every day. And thankfully, it's picked up by other stations, and it has a very, very healthy audience. It's provable by the metadata. We get tens of thousands listening every afternoon, and that's a lovely thing. But I've been told by colleagues of mine at the BBC, ex-colleagues of mine, this year, Richie, you're in serious trouble. They're going to come and say that you've got to have a licence. And the reason they're going to do that is not just because it's fair that everybody should be regulated. It's because ultimately, Richie, they want... I'm not important, Stuart. I don't want to sound like I'm not important. The people who come on my show are important. I'm just a mouthy paddy. That's all I am. But what they want to do is they want to then say, you've got to have the Ofcom licence, and then they want to find you in breach of it so that they can ultimately get rid of you. That's coming down the line. No doubt about that.
Yeah, well, I tell you, I'll just chip in. It's just because I've been reading sort of legal theory, which is not my expertise at all, but it's very, very interesting, because what has happened over the last couple of decades is that they've lost control of the harm principle. Not to bore you excessively, but
this is interesting.
It's interesting, right? So basically, what happened is, in the 60s, a key aspect of law used to be that people would make a moral argument, right, that we need laws for moral reasons. And in the 60s, the kind of moral argument, traditional moral argument, started to decline, and the more liberal argument started to emerge and say, well, actually, we should only criminalize things that harm people, right? The classic John Stuart Mill principle, does it harm people? The conservative moral argument to justify law started to decline. So that sounds good, because it's just harm. So that, you know, homosexuality, that doesn't harm anybody. You know, so that should be legal. And so you were able to put the argument for legalizing things based on the harm principle. But what happened is that was a liberal moment, if you like, in a nice way in the 60s. But as soon as things started to become more conservative, people started to say, well, actually, that harms, right? So conservative people would say, well, beggars harm the community. You know, squeegee merchants harm this, people harm those people, they harm everything. And so we need to have more and more policing in New York and Giuliani and so on. And then radical people and feminists came in and said, well, actually, pornography harms, words harm, this harms, that harm. And now they can't put a cap on what harms, right? It's like the genie's out the bottle. And the expansion of harm is just escalating, so that, you know, we now get laws about emotional harm. You know, so the woman that battered her husband over the head with a hammer is now going to get done for manslaughter instead of murder. And, you know, that raises a question in my mind. Well, that's interesting. And this is all being done as this kind of coercive control. It's emotional abuse. And so what is being seen as problematic and damaging and dangerous for people is expanding and expanding to, and particularly to include words. You know, where we start talking about words as weapons, and people genuinely start to sort of experience and think about words as weapons. And once we're down that track, I mean, anything's possible.
Dr. Stuart Waiton, PhD, is our guest, folks. Stuart is an author, and he lectures in criminology and sociology at Abertay University. First came across him when he was on Sky News in the afternoon, and he had a really interesting conversation about these issues, about vulnerable groups, about free speech. We've had an enormous amount of comments on Twitter, genuinely. If anybody wants to see what people are tweeting me, go to twitter.com and just put Richie Allen Show into Twitter, but no spaces, so it's all one word, and you can see what people are tweeting to me. Rolling back against it, how difficult is it going to be when people run for the hills? Your pieces on the trans lobby were fair, they were thought-provoking, they were interesting, they were challenging. I'm not just saying that because you're here, I really believe that. And they were excellent, and you're unapologetic for asking some questions, getting people thinking. when you've got Martina Navratilova very strong in saying, look, it's unfair for a trans woman to compete. And then there's a bit of piling in. And then Martina regrettably comes out and says, I'm really sorry about that. I mean, if people are going to kind of capitulate so quickly, how are we going to roll back against this? How are you going to get young men and women? It sounds very patronising, but how are you going to get younger folks to kind of stop and think, well, no, this is not right that we're, you know, deplatforming people, that we're trying to protect people from here and stuff. We should just have a debate. Debates are fun, they're exciting. What are we going to have to do, Stuart, to stop this tidal wave of censorship?
Well, I tell you, it's quite interesting because, again, come back, and, you know, this is obviously, it's just a small kind of audience. But at the start, I lost the debate yesterday, but only just. But I started off by, I had more votes. So in the initial question of, this is about 130 students, 120 students, do you support freedom of speech as a principle, blah, blah. I think I got something like 47%. 42% said no, 11% said undecided. Now, at the end, I mean, as it happens, I think they were kind of more in the principle of general, yes, I support freedom of speech, but not really. In the end, it kind of shifted a bit. So it ended up he was 47%, I was 42%. But nevertheless, and I don't genuinely think 42% would... I'm not sure if they really would absolutely support freedom of speech, because I think it is a hard argument. I think it's a hard thing to argue, especially around issues of racism and all sorts of things. But nevertheless, I think young people in the last 5, 6, 7 years are now part of this discussion. So I had a discussion like this 6, 7 years ago, and it felt a little bit like, yeah, there was a couple of people there that knew this was an issue, but most of them, it was kind of, you know, neither here nor there. At this discussion, there was quite a lot of the people in the audience who had very specific ideas, who had read or knew this subject. They'd obviously seen things. I think there's loads of stuff on YouTube now where there's kind of people arguing on these points. So I was kind of heartened by that. I do think that this is now an issue. It's an issue that people are very, very aware of, and it's an issue. I think that there is a bit of a backlash amongst the younger generation, as well as old fogies like us who think, you know, which planet are we living on?
It's really good to hear that. And it's a bit of a smack on the wrist for me, probably deservedly as well, because I think I've begun to generalise and I've begun to adopt a kind of a dismissive attitude to 20-somethings. I have, and it's not healthy, because you were right when you said earlier on that, you know, I must be somebody who likes people, and I do, and I don't dismiss people. I had a very serious debate, not on the show, but in public, with people whom I met a couple of years ago who would be kind of more snowflakery, and I tried to impress upon them the notion, you know, that regardless of what somebody who lives near you thinks, you've got to live with them. You know, you can't send them off to an island. You can't send them to Coventry. We have to accept that there will be people living around us who have ideas about the world or worldviews that are very different to ours. And we can't obliterate them from our lives. And I've been trying to say that a lot over the years, you know, as a way of trying to get through to some people. And I think I have, despite generally loving meeting people, and I love hearing people on the show who think differently than me, I've become very dismissive and almost a bit hostile towards younger folks. I have begun to paint them with kind of one brush. You can't, and you don't do that, because, of course, you work with teenagers and 20-somethings every day, although it must be exasperating sometimes.
The interesting thing, I think, is that actually the students who I would profoundly disagree with generally don't perk up. They're much happier to sort of say things behind your back,
right,
when they give kind of feedback on your module or if there's going to be a kind of campaign. So, you know, most of the students that come and discuss things are, you know, I think relatively relaxed relatively open to, but you know, this is, it's partly, I suspect, because I'm perhaps in a university in Dundee. If I was in a university in London, I might have a different experience, I think, because I think there's a bit more kind of slightly more traditional approach to things. But I don't know. I think in general, the number of people who are hardened victim advocates is small. I think most young people kind of might not agree with what I say, but they're not absolute about it. They're not kind of running around trying to spring down statues and you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, that is, I genuinely think that is a very small percentage of people. It's just unfortunate that that very small percentage of people are the people who are influential. And actually, I mean, more than anything, we should be looking at our politicians and institutions, because they are the ones who are, have introduced laws and who constantly use this as a kind of moral crutch. You know, the sort of anti-racism or up here, anti-sectarianism, it's a moral crutch. It's like, it's constant virtue signaling where they feel, you know, they can puff their chest out. You know, they can puff their chest out about almost nothing of substance, but they can puff their chest out about this and feel really morally superior and good. And I mean, that they're the ones I think we should be really trying to target. And, you know,
brilliantly said that.
We can just do our best, I suppose.
Well, that's right. And I'm going to ask you, we've got about 2 minutes before we wrap it up. We saw that with people like Stella Creasy whining about knife crimes and reading out people's names and all this grandstanding. We've seen it over the anti-Semitism allegations. Well, I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned institutions. Final question today. Thanks for coming back. Dr. Stuart Waiton has been our guest this hour, folks. Stuart, you mentioned institutions. Are we going to have to take a very hard look at the power wielded by Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, who maybe we can make an argument are no longer just companies that can do what they want? They've outgrown company status. They're more like states on their own. Are we going to have to, you know, and I'm no communist, but are we going to have to maybe intervene and say, well, look, you have a responsibility not to be just blocking people because of something they said or something you deem to be morally wrong? Do we need to look much harder at that? Their power.
I'll just throw this in. I think there's something in the anti-Semitism thing, by the way, but that's for another show. Maybe.
Yeah, we'll do that another time. Yeah.
Just sort of throw that in. But Facebook, it was interesting. I was listening to Brendan O'Neill, who writes for Spiked, and he was on a show, and he was making the point, which I thought was very interesting, that in America, the Supreme Court made a ruling about this, where you have companies that are so big that they essentially own the town, right? Because what you get sometimes is, you know, these places in the back of beyond, where they kind of, the one company owns everything. And the company says, well, because we own everything here, nothing's really a public space, so we can decide how people behave. And the Supreme Court made a ruling and said, well, actually, no, once you become so big that you are essentially, you know, the controller of this public arena, then you have to abide by the general rules of society and allow the freedoms of that society. And the argument is that, well, Facebook has become this. Facebook has become a public space with however many billion people that are on it, where people have open discussions, and actually they have a responsibility. On the other hand, I mean, what you would want is you would want people to put pressure on them through arguments, because it is a business. It is someone's private business. And ultimately, they can make a decision themselves, as anyone who runs a private business, about who's allowed on and who isn't allowed on. But I would absolutely think it would be very important to campaign for Facebook to stop banning people, because it is a very dangerous starting point for limiting public discussion. And as you say, you know, we need more public discussion, not less of it.
Yeah, it's a good point that rather than politicians or governments enforcing this or that create the space for an argument and a debate with the people who run these companies. Certainly a better way of doing it. You mentioned Spiked. You can read Stuart at Spiked Online, folks, as well. Spiked-online.com. There are a number of articles there that Stuart has written over the last few years. They are very interesting. Again, I'm not saying it because he is here. Thought-provoking stuff, challenging stuff, which is important. Thanks for coming back today, Stuart. Always good to have you on. And I hope you come back again in the future. Cheers, mate.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thanks, Stuart. That was Dr. Stuart Waiton, PhD. Stuart lectures in sociology and criminology at the University of Abertay in Dundee. He's an author as well. I have tweeted out links. I will tweet out more links to where you can find out more about Stuart. These are very, very interesting times. I've said it before and I'll say it again. No matter what I might think of somebody, anybody, whether it be somebody on the far right or anywhere else, I will never support the banning of that person by any organisation, by any social media institution. I will never accept it as long as I live. Not because I'm some sort of mart or some sort of virtue signaller. Never in my career have I felt it was appropriate for somebody to be banned for saying something. Even if it is something like denying the Holocaust, which seems to offend so many, especially so many whom are not Jewish or who don't have any links to Jews. I've been asked the question 1,000 times, why have you spoken with people who deny this or who say this? And I say, well, because I will speak to anybody, whether I agree or disagree with them. And while I accept that some people have the right to be wound up or annoyed because their great-grandfather or grandmother died in a concentration camp, I accept they have the right to be peeved off by somebody saying, well, I don't believe any of that, and I don't think for a minute that your grandparents were involved in anything like that. They have a right to be annoyed or wound up by that, but they also have a right to ignore it. And it's very easy. Being offended is a subjective thing. It's a conscious choice. I've said it before. I had a Jewish man say to me before when I was in Spain, when I interviewed, I can't remember who it was, but it was somebody who asked questions about the numbers of people killed and what have you. But we weren't talking about that. We were talking about something else. Why did you have that person on? I said, how could it possibly wind you up? You don't know the guy. You've got no connection to him. Just ignore it. It's a conscious choice to be wound up or to be offended by somebody. It's very easy. I said it today about the former Labour MP, of course, Luciana Berger. I've said it before about Rachel Riley, the woman who does the mathematics on Countdown. If somebody calls you an effing bitch or if somebody says you should be raped, first of all, they probably are hiding in a bedroom somewhere with a computer on their lap. Utterly cowardly. They're using a pseudonym. Just block them. It's not serious. If you think it is serious, pop it off to your local police force and block them and you won't have to read it again. The likelihood of that person confronting you and really raping you is in the billions to one. You've chosen to be wound up by it. Don't be wound up by it. Like I said before, if you'd seen some of the stuff sent to me over email, some of the things tweeted to me, threats, physical threats, where my partner has been named and mentioned, and things that would happen to me because of my opinions, I just ignore them. I don't go looking for attention. Oh, look at me, I'm being threatened, my family's being threatened. I just ignore, laugh at it, delete it, mute or block and move on. How could anybody that you've never met before in your life, that has no claim to you, either as a friend or as a family member, how could they ever wind you up? Honest to Christ, like, how could some fool saying, you big ignorant Irish baldy wanker, the Irish are thick, you're a fraud, how could that possibly offend me? It would upset me if it was coming from somebody that I value, that I love, or that I like, and I would say, well, why are you saying that? Let's have a conversation. But coming from somebody whom I never have or never will meet, come on. You know, it's funny, isn't it? Let's go then. Thanks so much to Stuart Waiton, PhD, and Paul Craig Roberts, of course, paulcraigroberts.org. That was a fascinating conversation, I think. I'll be back with you tomorrow. Among the guests are Dr. Tony Bark, MD. First on the show 3 years ago, and she hasn't been back. Not because she didn't want to come back, but she's a busy woman. We're going to be talking about recent comments by NHS England about dealing with those who are sceptical about the benefits of vaccination. It's all getting very Orwellian here in the UK. Dr. Tony Bark, MD, joins the programme tomorrow. Closing out with Snow Patrol's run, I'm going to go and watch my football team get knocked out of the Champions League. That's what I'm going to do. You enjoy the rest of your Wednesday. See you tomorrow. Bye.